And Natasha is right here. Good morning and welcome, Natasha.
Good morning, Vern.
And let's jump right in on this recording. Was this kind of the recording you put together for your Represent Yourself recording at some point in your career, this Brahms, Kahane, and Prokofiev recording?
Yeah, you could say that. I had about two concerto CDs behind me, both in my teens, both when I was about 14, 15. But I had not had a solo recital CD, and I had won the Classical Recording Foundation Artist of the Year, and part of that prize was to record a solo CD, and it came at the perfect time for me to do so. And I had commissioned Gabe Kahane to write a sonata, his first classical piece, actually. Gabe is the very prodigious son of course, Jeffrey Kahane.
Oh, okay, there we go.
Pianist,
okay.
Yeah. And Gabe is a singer-songwriter. He's got bluegrass roots, jazz, classically trained, and great pianist, singer, and, you know, a real composer. I mean, this is not the sonata on this album is, lest you think it's a jazz composer trying to be classical. It's really not. It's like a really great piece.
As long as you've said that and you've introduced it so well, I think we could take the 3 minutes and enjoy the last movement of his sonata. That gives us a sense. This is kind of one of those wild and crazy last movements that he wrote for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not the easiest piece to play by any means. In fact, even when Jeffrey looked at the sonata, he was like, what? How did you play this? I'm like, I don't remember.
But you were young and foolish, so you did.
Yeah.
Okay, let's hear this, and then we'll come back for more conversation. This is Natasha Peremsky and Gabe Kahane's Allegro from his piano sonata dedicated to her. spell there with the last movement of Gabe Kahane's piano sonata was the person it's dedicated to, Natasha Peremsky. So, Natasha, do you keep that piece around and play it occasionally?
Yeah, absolutely. But keeping it around is it's such a difficult piece that, you know, it just commands respect. So, yeah.
Well, yeah. we'll suspend that part of the discussion till we start talking about Rachmaninoff 3, but let's talk about other things. In between time, when you talked earlier about this recording you made, you said you had done a couple of concertos as a kid, as a teenager. You've kind of had two lives and two careers, haven't you, already in your short time? I mean, between...
Child actor and...
yeah, you got it. Well, just kind of like the really young pianist and then... Then coming into your own, talk about the wholeness of your career so far.
Well, yeah, I guess I was considered a prodigy because I don't know what that means anyway. I guess it's someone who plays pieces that are not expected of them to play at a very young age.
And you were in Russia at the time?
No, I think it came into my own, actually, in the States.
And you were how old then?
My family emigrated when I was 8. So, and then I didn't play for a year because my parents couldn't afford it. And then I just could not play, and I begged them to, if I could start piano lessons again. And they had to make a lot of financial sacrifices for me to do that because in Russia, the things that were free in America are not free. Mm-hmm. And so they really put their, you know, put everything into my dreams, so to speak. And it was at 11 years old, well, actually at 9 years old, I played my first concerto with orchestra, and that was the Haydn D major. Mm-hmm. With a youth symphony in the Palo Alto area of California. And then when I was 11, I played my first solo recital. And I think that's when I knew that I really loved doing it and wanted to pursue it professionally. And then at 14, I recorded my first CD, and 15, my second CD. At 17, made my debut with San Francisco Symphony. And then I got management and started traveling. And I've been traveling ever since. So I wouldn't really say if there were... Yes, there are two phases because obviously I'm, you know, not 17 anymore. And play differently now. But it was all kind of very seamless because I've been on the road professionally since I was 17.
Since you were a kid, yeah. And so it's kind of, you say it was seamless, and therefore it's kind of just gone that one thing leads to another, and you've been able to do things like be in London with the Royal Philharmonic last week.
Yeah, I call that bad geographical planning.
Well, yeah, but isn't that the fact of you jet setter musicians' lives?
You become so... You know, every time you're on the freaking plane going from London to Spokane, you're like, I will never do this again. Mm-hmm. I will never put my body through this. This is madness. And then you think, but that's what I thought last year when I flew from Hawaii to Germany for a 34-hour journey and played Rock 3 on one end and Rock 2 on the other. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I will never do this again. I won't do this to my body. Here we are again. It's like you're numb to it for some reason when you're making the decision. Obviously, you know, the requests come in quite a bit in advance, and you think, yeah, whatever. You know, yeah, I complained, but, you know, I got through it, and it was glorious, and it was fine, and yeah, I'm sure I can handle it again. And then you get here, and you're like, oh, my God. Why do I forget every time?
Natasha Peremsky, who is playing Rachmaninoff with the Gonzaga Symphony tonight at the Fox. Do you do right now in your life lots and lots of concertos? Is that more what you're doing than recitals and chamber music, or is it pretty well mixed?
I would say it's concertos, chamber music recitals, more concertos, and then chamber music recitals sort of equal chamber music and recitals, usually in the summer, with some recitals interspersed throughout the year.
Do you have some regular festivals that you tend to go to in the summer?
Well, there's the Sitka Summer Music Festival.
Yes, yes, there
run
is.
By the one and only. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because you can, we should mention two years ago you came here playing mm-hmm. with Zuel Bailey, and you played here and in Coeur d'Alene and in Medellin Falls mm-hmm. and throughout the area. So you are continuing to sometimes play with Zuel. You've been to Sitka since then, have you?
Oh yeah, yeah. Every year actually since 2013.
Yeah.
And we've recorded a couple of CDs together. We play recitals together all the time. And
yeah. And then who are some other people you play with, or what are some other instrumentalists or singers that you play with?
You know, I do a lot of trios and quartets and the like.
So you play with a lot of string players, probably?
Yeah, although in October, I did a program of two clarinet sextets, and one piece with clarinet. So that was fun. And then a couple of years ago, I did the Dohnányi sextet, and that's with horn and clarinet mm-hmm. and strings. But at chamber music festivals, a lot of the time, you actually do really end up playing a lot of string music.
Sure. That's always the core group. And
it's the core group, yeah.
Whatever quartet or quintet they're going to play at any point in that. So what about solo recitals? That's kind of often talked. Is that a dying medium? Is it so rare that one gets to do one?
Yeah, I think it's a tough niche, I think, especially in this country. Abroad, it's a bit more common to actually do recitals. You end up doing a lot more recitals in Europe than you do here in the States. And I think there's, a number of series have experienced dwindling support for their, mm-hmm. recital seasons. But I'm actually doing for the very first time, I haven't been put in this position yet, but braced myself and I'm ready for it. Next year I'm playing in Portland, the Portland Piano International Series, and they do two recitals. They make you do two recitals back to back, January 14 and 15, and I'm doing two completely different programs.
Wow. Okay.
Solo recital.
And when you do a solo recital in 2016, do you kind of do the formula that's always been there with a couple Scarlatti sonatas and a Beethoven sonata and something like by Debussy or Scriabin and then a contemporary piece or something like that? Or is there an overall sense of what one does or doesn't do in a piano sonata?
Well, that's a tough question. I know what you're talking about, because that was definitely at one point the sort of blueprint or the mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it for, you know, putting together a recital. But frankly, I just want to play the pieces I want to play, and I want them to make sense together. So this season I'm doing Brahms Paganini Variations, Beethoven Opus 110, and then Pictures at an exhibition on the second half. And of course, all my friends are like, "You're crazy." Like, sure. Yeah, but I love those pieces. Yeah. So, and then for Portland Piano, I've got, I'm not doing Pictures because they already had Pictures. So it was kind of a challenge to put two programs together that don't overlap with the pianists they've had in previous seasons.
Sure.
And I was actually incredibly shocked that they hadn't had anyone play Rachmaninoff's second piano sonata. I was like, no way. Okay, Pictures I expected. Half expected Beethoven Opus 110, but no, that one was fine. Prokofiev sonatas they've had, but Rachmaninoff's second sonata, I mean, it's like the competition piece, mm-hmm. like everybody plays that, I thought. But they hadn't had that and I jumped on that opportunity, and so I'm doing a German recital the second day or the first day, one of the days. And then the other day, I'm doing Tom Addis mazurkas. He wrote those mazurkas inspired by Chopin's mazurkas. So I think I'm probably going to intersperse them with some mazurkas, do a Chopin scherzo. That's the first half and the second half. I'll do the Rachmaninoff Sonata. I can't quite remember what I paired it with, but I think I paired it with something else. And yeah, and then the second recital is going to be Brahms Paganini, Beethoven Opus 110, Brahms Third Sonata in the second half. So you just kind of get creative. If you want to make a theme, like some people are really good at thematic stuff. Personally, I don't like the confinement of
sure.
thematic stuff, because you end up kind of plugging things in that you don't really like to play, but it just because it makes sense with the theme. And
so you play music.
Yeah, I want to play music.
Well, as long as you mentioned Rachmaninoff, that's the elephant in the room right now, because because you are playing the famous, or if we would say infamous, Rachmaninoff Third Concerto tonight, and then you alluded to having recently played both the second and third concerto. Have you played all four of them in your career so far?
No. I'm playing the first for the first time next season, but no one's pushed four on me yet.
Mm. And what do you mean by that? Is it harder or less satisfying, or just something new to learn?
The fourth?
Yeah.
The fourth is such a beautiful piece. It's very challenging. It's probably just as challenging as the third. But I think because the second and the third and the Paganini are so recognizable, and they're just such like perfect pieces of music, orchestras tend to gravitate more to them because, you know, it's kind of a slam dunk. Mm. And then usually if they do program the fourth, you have to have, you know, sort of either an artist of, you know, kind of household name stature to sort of pull it off, mm-hmm. as far as, you know, ticket sales.
Sure.
Or have, like, you know, Rachmaninoff Second Symphony on the second half, yeah. or something, you know, to, like, draw them in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a beautiful piece. He had a hard time writing it, actually. It took him a really, really long time, like years and years. Whereas the third, it was like a torrent. And it really feels like that. You just know he just sat down, improvised it, and then wrote it down. And it really just seems like this boom, stream of, it's improvisatory. It's, the themes are amazing. The development of the thematic material is unbelievable. And it just works so well, you know. At the end of it, you're like, wow, that's, you know, every time I listen to anybody play it, I just always remind myself, wow, this is really a great piece. And the second concerto, another great example, he came out of his writer's block, and he just, it was like, a torrent. He just sat down and wrote it.
Nice. And so these two really favorite concertos. For you to be playing the third, have you only recently added it to your repertoire, or have you been playing it for a while?
Well, you know, and compared to the second and Paganini, yes, recently. But since I've added it, I've played it more than the second and Paganini. And that was at the beginning of January 2013 was the first time I played it. And ever since then, I've played it a handful of times every year, like at least 10, 15 times every year.
So then that allows you to keep the notes under your fingers. Talk a little bit about my guest, Natasha Peremski, playing Rachmaninoff tonight. Talk about within this crazy world of going halfway around the world from gig to gig and things like that, how do you plan your practice and your own study and the work you do? Catch as catch can?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And I freak out massively if I don't know that there will be a piano available at all times for me to do so. Like right now I am slammed. You know, some weeks are easier than others, but usually when you're at the beginning of, a long string of performances where you're carrying a lot of repertoire, that's when I'm the most stressed out, because you're just carrying this massive load. And right now I'm carrying a massive load of repertoire. And I usually just absolutely make sure with presenters when I'm on the road that I can have access to a piano. And I usually say, seriously, I am fine with an 88-key weighted keyboard. Mm-hmm. Just give me something so I can keep wrapping my fingers around things. But that's things that, you know, if you're a string player, you don't have to wonder about.
Sure.
You don't have to think, oh, my gosh, when am I going to practice? Where am I going to practice? I should schedule it. I should call people, see if they could pick me up and take me to the venue to go practice. You know, that's the one thing I'm always envious of string players and portable instruments about. If only I was a violinist.
So do you have stories of when you were practicing on the ballroom piano at the hotel and the janitor came and threw you out and things like that? Have there been strange events like that?
Oh, yeah. There's always stuff like that. Actually, I remember I was, I'm not going to name the orchestra, but it was a few years ago as an orchestra. And I was playing Brahms' First Piano Concerto. And I
speaking of big pieces.
Yeah. I don't play the small stuff, Vern. I have this, it's an ironclad routine before every performance. No matter what the piece, no matter how well I know it or how new it may be to me, I have to have at least an hour and a half right before I walk on stage where I go through the piece super slowly. On any kind of piano, again, keyboard is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at this orchestra, and they said, yeah, no worries, the musician's lounge, you know, as long as you don't care that they're in there, in the green room, you can absolutely use that piano. I said, yeah, I don't care, you know, you learn to block things out and just kind of do your own thing. And one of the musicians freaked out. He absolutely lost it. And he went to the management and he said, excuse me, this is my private time that I need to have silence. All I do is play music all day long. I don't need to be listening to Brahms' First Piano Concerto before we're about to walk on stage. And the management came up to me and they said, we're going to have to stop you because you're bothering one of the musicians. And I just broke down crying. Literally, I had a meltdown. I'm supposed to go on stage in half an hour to play one of the most challenging piano concertos. And I mean, this music is so, playing Brahms is like having, you know, all the going through the spectrum of human emotion, and especially this, you know, Titanic First Piano Concerto. And I was just, and it was one of my first performances of it, and I was already stressed out. And for someone, you know, to be so kind of, it was unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because there were places they could go, but I couldn't go anywhere else. So I thought. And then they said, oh, we forgot to tell you, there's an upright downstairs in a private room. Oh my gosh. And then I actually broke down even more. So we didn't have to go through any of this.
Yeah.
So there's always something, and it's always, or people just, one thing I have learned, one of my boundaries is that for certain pieces, like Rock 3, for example, I absolutely have to have a piano. You know, if I can go to a venue and they can say, if I'm playing Chopin Concerto and they can say, we don't have a piano backstage, I can maybe swallow that bitter pill. But with Rock 3, no ifs, ands, or buts. Why? Because it is physically challenging. And as such, it becomes like, you become an athlete, and it's you actually risk injury going out and playing something like this cold. Truly. So I always say, look, and I've learned that if I just get in touch with a venue in enough notice, they can at least bring in a keyboard.
Sure.
But those are the boundaries you learn. You just say, look, I'm sorry, you cannot expect me to walk on stage and play this cold. So
I'm spending time with Natasha Peremsky, who tonight with the Gonzaga Symphony plays this aforementioned Rock 3. And in a little bit, we're going to hear the conclusion of it. But I guess kind of my final question for you is that with all of this big, hard stuff you play, in addition to being an artist, which you absolutely are, do you think of yourself as an athlete? Do you live an athlete's life? What is the physicality of your life?
Oh, you mean at the piano?
Yeah.
It's Rock 3 is a great example. I now have a much more close relationship to it, having played it so many times. But when I first performed it, actually, let me even go back to when I first played it through, when I was learning it, and it took me. It was kind of like a gun to the head learning experience because I had 5 weeks to do it. And I was playing 7 concertos during those 5 weeks and recording. So, my friends were like, "Where'd you go?" I said, "I've been at the piano for 13 hours a day for 5 weeks straight. I'm at plus airplanes, plus recording sessions. I'm not of this world right now." So I'll catch you when I catch you. And I remember at the end of those 5 weeks, I attempted to run through, of course, solo and orchestra. And I remember I got to the end of the first movement and I was like, holy moly, I am so tired. I am exhausted. And I've got 2 more movements to go, which, by the way, are equal in length. It is a solid 46-minute concerto. You've got 15 minutes of first movement, 15 minutes of second movement, which is supposed to be slow, but nothing slow about it. And then the third movement is 18 minutes. And I'm just sitting there at the end of the first 15 minutes, and I'm thinking, I cannot believe this. And then, of course, every day it gets a little easier. But then the first performance, I thought, oh my God, I'm exhausted. Then I have to play this again tomorrow? Oh my God. And I just thought, there's no way. How do people do this? What if someone asked me to like go on tour with it? I mean, I can't imagine it. And then about a year later, I played 4 Rock 3s in a row, like 4 days in a row. And I thought, oh, wow, this is really happening. You know, so it's really like to relate it to exercise. You know, people say you plateau in exercise. Why? Because your body gets used to it. So you do something, you do an exercise routine. Let's say you take a video, you know, like a cardio kickbox video, right? And it's extremely taxing and it's extremely aerobic. And the first time you do it, you think you're going to die. You really think you're going to die. Your heart's pumping, your muscles are sore the next day. And the next day you do it, you're like, oh my God, I can't lift my arms. And then about 2 months, you don't even break a sweat anymore because your body actually seriously adapts to it. So where before, like 2 years ago, I would have to start rehearsing Rock 3 at least 3 weeks before the first performance. Now I can get away with a couple of days because it's so sewn in into my muscle fibers somewhere deep inside that, you know, if I don't play it for 8 months and someone jumps it on me, like a cancellation, I can take it. Whereas I probably could not have done that 2 years ago. So it is incredibly physical. There's so much about it, especially the third movement. It's just like, you know, like roll up your sleeves and like start lifting weights. You know, like it really is like cardio exercise.
So that's what we get to experience, the art and the athleticism of Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto, also music of Beethoven and Weber, tonight on that 7:30 concert at the Fox. And we have queued up the end of it. We're going to, let's see if we still have it sitting available to us. This is my guest, Natasha Peremsky, in about the last 7 minutes of Rachmaninoff 3. So, Natasha, thanks so much for coming to town.
Thank you, Vern.
And here it is. a performance with the Bergen Philharmonic Orchestra of the end of the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto, Andrew Litton conducting. We took that off of YouTube just to represent the rest of that piece. And that was Natasha Peremsky, who once again, to reiterate, is doing that with the Gonzaga Symphony tonight at 7:30 at the Fox.